good afternoon and welcome into another afternoon of Woods and Water, South Carolina. My name is Roger Metz, and you're tuned in to 94.5 WGTK, The Answer in Greenville, South Carolina. Hope this cooler weather has felt kind of nice to be May. And it looks like it's going to start warming up by the end of the week. But goodness gracious, if you can't find something to do outside today, at least go outside and sit on the back porch or just enjoy the sunset tonight. It's going to be a beautiful weekend in South Carolina. If you didn't make it down to Eastover or McIntyre Air National Guard Base today, you still got one more chance. The South Carolina Guard Expo is taking place again tomorrow. Gates open at 9 o'clock. It is free to get in. They have the Southeastern Food Truck Association there with over 120 food trucks, in addition to almost 4 hours of flying demonstrations and ground demonstrations. I was there Wednesday for media day and had just an absolute ball. I did talking to the guard going on the base, and he was trying to tell me exactly where to go, and there was a pilot standing there, and he said, "Sir, are you headed to the media area?" And he turned around, and it was Major Madrid, who I interviewed last weekend, so I got to meet him and talk to him for a little bit. Went down and got to meet Ed Snyder, the gentleman who is their media relations officer. And everyone was so nice. They wanted us there. They wanted to tell you all how much they appreciated the support you give them. They are essentially South Carolina's Air Force and Army. And they're busy. Some of the helicopter crews were coming back from a deployment in Afghanistan. Some of the other helicopter crews are getting ready to deploy to Afghanistan. And then the F-16s are headed to Australia. So, and that's why they really haven't had another air show since 2009, because they're almost an active duty, unit when it comes to their deployments and all. So, 2009 to 2017, 8 years, and they've been busy ever since. Which is why this is so special, and they're putting so much effort into this expo, is because they don't get to do it very often. So from all the men and women at the South Carolina Air Guard and the Army National Guard, they want to say thank you for your support. Hope you can make it down tomorrow and be a part of the Air Expo and see some really great flying. When we got there Wednesday morning, the F-16s were up and flying around. Sound of Freedom is what they were trying to do the press conference, and you had some coming in to land and some making low passes and breaks for landing. And he said, you just never get tired of the Sound of Freedom. And that's exactly what it was. So anyway, had a great time. Got to ride in a Black Hawk helicopter. Got to ride in a Bradley armored vehicle. And the interesting thing is, when you talk to these people, it's not like you're active units that are rotating in and out. I mean, most of these people have been there 15, 20, 25 years. And South Carolina residents, I'm one of the Chinook pilots that I met Wednesday, lives in Simpsonville. I forget, and I'm sorry about this, the two gentlemen that spoke, the head of the air wing and the head of the base, one was employed by an electrical contractor there in Columbia, and another was a Delta Airlines pilot. So they, during the week, they have jobs just like the rest of us. And, on weekends, during emergencies, when their country calls on them, they go put on a uniform and are some of the best trained armed forces that we have. So enough about that, but I hope you will get down. I want to personally thank them for a great day Wednesday. I'm looking forward to being down there tomorrow myself to see the whole air show in its entirety. And, look forward to keeping you posted on their deployments and all. And if you have a moment from time and again to remember them in your prayers, they are in harm's way when they're on these deployments, a lot of them. And you get that when you talk to them. So anyway. But, let's see. Today's show is going to be OSearch. Back in March, OSearch, which is the International Shark Tagging organization, headed up by Chris Fisher, who kind of is the face, and then Brett McBride, who is kind of the man that makes it all happen behind the scenes. They were here doing their low country expedition back in March. They invited me to come down. And of course, if you remember what March was like, it was, the weather was quite bad. And I think they were here about 3.5 weeks and got to fish about 4 days. And when you say, well, why can't they shark fish in bad weather? Well, go on the OSearch website or look for the vessel MV OSearch on the internet and look at it. And they've got the big platform that hangs off to the side. He said, you know, you can shark fish in almost any kind of weather. He said, but when you got 3-foot waves coming across that lift on the side of the boat, then you're really doing more damage to the shark because 1 second he's floating and 1 second he's being slammed down on the deck. So that's why they couldn't fish while we were there. The wind was blowing 25, 30 miles an hour. There was 2 to 3 foot or higher white caps coming across the bay right there north of Hilton Head. And so we didn't get to fish, but we got out on the boat that morning. Just had time to mingle. I talked to Brett several times. I talked to Chris several times. Talked to some of the crew members. They gave us a tour of the whole boat, including the engine room and the 4 barrels of Kentucky whiskey that they take on every cruise. And as the cruise is over, they auction that off and raise money. And that's how they're funded by donations. But anyway, got some great science lessons in why they're doing this. I think both of them, their end goal is not to say, look, sharks, you can't catch a shark and you can't do this because the stocks look good. Their research and all the blood samples they're getting, the tissue samples, all that they're scraping the shark's skin to see where they're going. And he said, all the research says that, you know, our populations are pretty good. And if that's the case, then let's move on and find another animal or fish that needs help, and let's do research on it too. So today pretty much is an interview with Brett McBride. He's a California-born, California West Coast fisherman. Got an interesting story how he and Chris met up and how they started OSearch and out of a TV fishing show, really. And if you were around in the late 90s and 2000s, you know the fishing show. And where it's taking them and where they want it to go on down there. What kind of legacy do they want to leave for the next generation? I think you'll find that really inspiring because they want to leave a cleaner, healthier ocean for everyone to enjoy. And they say, you know, look, it's not, we don't want to do this research and jump to conclusion that, oh, we can't keep a fish. No, they grew up fishing. Both of them did. And they want healthy oceans and they want people to go fish and be able to take them home and eat them. And it's not all about catch and release and shark being an apex predator in the ocean. If the shark populations are healthy, then you know most of the fish stocks are healthy too, because that's what sharks eat for the most part. That and seals, and occasionally they'll bite one of us, I think, like they did down off Folly Beach the other day. But anyway, I hope you will enjoy this interview. It's 27 minutes, so we're going to split it up through the second, third segment of the show today. But I hope you listen. Enjoy. This is information. Getting to know the two guys that run OSearch, Brett this time, and we'll do Chris on down the road a little ways. But I had a great time. It was windy and cold, but a lot of information there. They invited me to come back up to Cape Cod within the summer. Whether I can do that or not, I don't know. But it's an invitation that I'll think about. So anyway, I hope you enjoy the show today. And we'll have the calendar of events in the last segment. And again, hope you can make it down to South Carolina Guard Expo and enjoy meeting Brett McBride from OSearch. I've been fortunate enough to do a lot of things in the 3 or so years of this radio show, and one of them is happening today after about 4 or 5 reschedules because of weather, and which, you know, winter finally got here in March in South Carolina. But I'm off on the OSearch boat today and just having a ball and learning more than I ever thought I could. But one of the names in OSearch is Brett McBride, and he's sitting here across the heater from me because it's a little chilly out here. And I've enjoyed talking to him a lot today, off and on, about just chit-chat and all. But I wanted him to sit down and tell you a little bit about OSearch and a little bit about himself. So start off and just tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, where you live. Yeah. I know you got two kids, and important to be a dad. So just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Excuse me. Okay. Well, hello. Yeah. Nice to meet you and be here talking with you. I guess a little bit about me. I'm from San Diego, California. I'm a dad. I have two kids. I have a 13-year-old daughter, 12-year-old son back at home. So I kind of split my time between the boat here and getting back home. You know, I share some duties with a relief skipper and a good crew of guys that take care of the boat when I'm off the boat. So, but you know, I grew up in San Diego, California. I grew up fishing out of you know, Fisherman's Landing, Point Loma Sport Fishing, sport fishing fleet out of there. I started fishing out of there when I was about five.
Wow.
And I started actually working on boats the summer after sixth grade. And worked my way through junior high school and high school on the summers and the weekends, and that's all I ever really wanted to do, you know, is just be a boat captain since I first stepped on one about 5 years old. So I feel fortunate in that respect, and I've never really been too confused about what my path in life was going to be, just how I was going to get it done. But, so yeah, it's all, you know, I'm a West Coast style fisherman for the most part.
Okay.
You know, I met, you know, I went, well, there, after I got out of high school, you know, I graduated in 1985 from Hawaii High School. In 1987, I moved to Cabo San Lucas and started running boats down there. And I was actually there for about 21 years total. But I met Chris down there. A friend of mine, Billy Sida, was running his 48 Viking at the time. And Billy called me up and asked me if I'd fill in for him for a while, maybe permanently, and it ended up being permanent. Chris and I were only a year apart. So.
Okay.
Was running his 48 Viking for a while. We were fishing marlin tournaments and just, you know, cruising around, having a good old time fishing. We used the boat a lot. We started doing offshore adventures about a year later.
Okay.
He bought a 72-foot Elliott yacht fisher, a little more designed for, you know, a little more fuel, a little more bait capacity, water, and everything else, and redundancies, and so you can travel further in comfort, but still fish. You know, not as well as you can on a sport fisher.
Sure.
But it hold more bait,
right.
And, you know, so it allow us to get to places. And my style of fishing since I've been younger had always been on bigger, you know, started on the sport boat, so cruising around at 10 knots was very normal for me.
Okay.
You're always able to put a lure in the water. But, you know, so we the design of Offshore Adventures was it was fishing, and it was spearfishing, and it was culinary, and it was travel.
Oh yeah.
You know, so it really did incorporate something for the whole family. The wives and the children got into it just as much as the hardcore fishermen and family. If that was the father, so it was good for ratings. You know, because
sure.
it really did well. It was, I think, after four airings, I think it grabbed the number one slot on the outdoor block and held that for the entire, I think we did 180 something episodes over the course of about 7 years. There were two seasons, there was 14 seasons, two seasons per year. So it was a great time in my
yeah.
life, you know. But I was spending 300 days a year on the water those years, and that's no way to raise a family. So,
right.
And you know what happened? And really, what happened is, you know, we got we started going so far and had bigger plans, and we had already been, you know, going up from Alaska down to Ecuador and to, you know, to Florida, and just with a camera crew there, and. With all the gear we had, because we like to spearfish and we like to, you know, do any foul weather gear and everything else, it got really, really crowded. We were sleeping on the salon floor every night and stepping over each other. And so we had, you know, Chris had been looking for a bigger boat.
Right.
So the way it transitioned into this was, you know, we were looking to try to get a 100-foot boat that was a mothership at the time for us, for an innovator, for a smaller boat. We couldn't get that one, and it fell through a few times. It was called the OP, Ocean Pacific, and it was an awesome boat. Chris ended up finding the owner of this boat, Frank Miles. He ran into Chris down in Costa Rica, and over a conversation and a signature on a napkin, they made a deal. Chris came over and he's like, "Hey, I found the bigger boat. It's already a deal. And come, let me show it to you." And I was like, "Oh, no, you know." And he came and showed me this, and I was like, "Oh boy, what have I gotten myself into here? I don't know how to run a boat like that, or how to maintain a boat like that, how big of a crew I would need, and how to fish it. You know, I mean, it's not a fishing boat. It's
right.
It's a mode of transportation from one spot to another. I spent my whole life, you know, wherever I am traveling, I'm fishing as well.
Right.
If I see a spot of birds and porpoise and tuna, whatever, I can turn on it and go into fishing mode. When I couldn't do that.
Not on this one.
So, yeah, so things change a lot. We tried to do another season of Offshore Adventures, I think, on this, or half a season. It was like sticking a square peg in a round hole trying to do that. But then fortunately, you know, we'd started working with scientists on the Go Fish. We had done some tagging blue and black marlin and sailfish and dragging some plankton nets through water, current breaks, and analyzing what's in them and doing several different birds and tortoise or turtle studies and several things. And so we had dabbled in working with science, with the scientists, and we enjoyed it. And we, you know, got some gratification out of it. So when we were asked to try to put a white shark on the lift here up, and we got this, it was really the only thing that we had going anyways, because I think Chris was about to sell the boat because it wasn't working with Offshore Adventures. So he asked me if he called me and said, "Hey, do you think you can put a white shark on that lift and get a tag on it?" And I wasn't going to say anything but yes. And I'm like, of course. I don't know how yet. Let me see exactly what we got in mind. And where we wanted to start was over in Guadalupe Island. You know, that's where they have some of the biggest ones that we've ever seen, and the deepest water. And that poses a lot more of a problem. Most of the sharks over here, I mean, we're thrown in the deep end over there. I mean, if we had started over here on some smaller sharks in shallower water and fine-tuned our stuff and then gone over there, it probably would have made more sense. And we would have had, you know, because we had some tackle. You know, it was hard to find a hook that didn't break. You know,
sure.
We were trying to bend a hook into a circle hook to be conscious of that. But, you know, and in the process of that, you weaken the metal and we break the hook that way. We had a couple, you know, failures, and that didn't hurt the shark anymore. We didn't kill anything over there, but we had some learning experiences on tackle. And then we had to go and ask, you know, like Mustad to make special hooks for us. So because we really over there you wouldn't be able to catch them rod and reel or anything like that anyway. So it wouldn't really come into play. It was pretty much right away. We knew we would have to go heavy, more stuff that you would see in a, you know, like swordfish commercial gear, you know,
okay.
Like buoys and ropes and
right.
Things like that. Not a harpoon, of course, but, at least that was the thing that made sense. But those are long battles, using buoys to pull them out of the depths. And, since then, most of the sharks, you know, we've gone to Africa, and, you know, we got 40 white sharks in Africa. Most of those sharks were in, you know, 60 feet of water or less. A lot of them were in 20 feet of water, 15 even. Come back over here, same thing, 60 feet or less off Cape Cod. Sometimes they're, you know, those things are swimming right up along the shoreline
right.
Of 6 feet of water looking for the seals, so it makes perfect sense. They're cruising the edge of those shoals and stuff like that, so that works to our advantage. If I can hook a shark in 25 feet of water, then the shark is 15 feet long. It's really limited in what it can do.
Yeah.
It's just going to go straight out one direction, and you'll be able to see that direction. And, you know, you'll clear your lines, and everybody's ready. We'll just go back up, put that line back in a basket, pull in the slack, because I've got, you know, two 300-pound horse Yamahas in the back.
Sure.
I'm not going to have a problem catching them and passing them. So you just, pull up, get your line back, pass them up, and then get right in front of them. And then you have to be able to put enough pressure on it to change its mind, break its will.
And you, there's a word, there's a phrase for that you use.
Yeah, they call it learned helplessness. When I mentioned that to some guys from SeaWorld, that's what we call that learned helplessness. When you overwhelm it and it knows it can't fight back, then it gives up and stops stressing out.
Okay.
Makes perfect sense. You would, same thing I think I mentioned earlier during that one presentation about, the towing trolling a 10-pound yellowfin tuna. You can troll it all day long trying to get a marlin to bite. As long as you're going the same speed, he's not killing himself.
Right.
He learns that he's following that boat in a certain direction. That's the only way he can go. And he settles in and he swims that, 3.5 knots all day long. And you match him on that, so you're never pulling on him. Or never creating a belly that he has to pull, so if everything will settle in right, you can both do that forever. So it's the same thing with the white shark, but you have to put enough pressure on them to do that. If that same tuna, if you had him on 5-pound test, he'll fight himself to death because he's actually fighting. He can win part of the battle.
Sure.
But if you always have him in the lead, then he swims along without any pressure. So that's what we're trying to do with the white sharks. And in the shallow water, we can do it fairly easily. You know, most of these sharks, you know, I say the fight's over in 5 to 10 minutes because to me it is over because we've gotten in front of him and taught him to follow us.
Okay.
And he's no longer stressing. He's just swimming. We haven't put him on the platform yet.
Sure.
So if you want to say, okay, you know, you're hauling him for another 20 minutes while the guys get the platform in the water, okay, well, you know, that's just...
Just like you're swimming along with it.
Yeah, but the shark at that point is the stress is going down, if anything.
Okay.
It'll come back up when I have to put the buoy on his face, of course, but we've tried to do that right before we come on the platform, spin the boat around, go into reverse, make it safe for me to reach down there, put the buoys on his face, turn around, go back into a lead again, and then we pull him onto the platform. And, you know, the blood work that they're getting from the sharks that are coming on the deck, they compare that with sharks that have been caught rod and reel, sharks that have been caught on long lines or in nets or anything else that are still alive. And it shows the stress factors are way, way better. And the interesting thing is they also show that this, you know, when we take blood from them right before they go in the water again,
okay,
so about 15 minutes later, and the stress is even more reduced. So from the time that they're on the platform, this is what a lot of people don't really understand. I think a lot of them are probably refuse to believe it, but the stress levels are reducing. So with the towel over their eyes,
yeah,
hose in their mouth, even though they're out of the water, they're calming down. You know, a lot of people say, well, why don't you do it boat side? It's got to be better, but it's not. It's just not better. I mean, the proof is in the science.
Okay.
If you believe in the science, then that's proof. I've always believed it because I can tell that the shark is still fighting when he's alongside the boat.
Okay.
Which means that if he's still fighting, his stress levels are up.
Sure.
And sometimes they're banging their, you know, eye against the side. So, that, you know, to me it was, and that's just our way. I'm not,
sure.
You know, I've never been one to say other people shouldn't. They don't have the opportunities, you know. But we do have a platform. I think it's the we're let's face it, we're getting sometimes 12 or 15 science studies done at one time on one shark. Much more comprehensive study in a bigger picture. I mean, so instead of just knowing where the shark goes, now you also know what's living on its skin, which tells you where it's been and what depth of water and other stuff. Parasites that are living there, well, can only be from this environment or that environment. You know, and that's just a simple way of looking at it. And they have, they're the smart ones. They're the scientists, right? I'm learning as I go as far as all the things that they're looking for. But I'm glad to be able to bring them the sharks as healthy as we can and let them up as healthy as we can. So.
You know, we were chatting earlier, and you know, I was asking you, you know, when you came here, of course, we had terrible weather for you guys. I apologize for that. Where you wanted to fish, and I would have expected you to say, you know, 20, 30 miles out, you know, where everybody thinks the big sharks roam or whatever, and you came up with something, you told me something totally different. So when you came here, your area you like to fish is pretty much right just off the beach.
Yeah, and there's a couple. I mean, there's some sharks out there for sure, but the ocean gets to become a very big place the further offshore you move. We're not looking for them so much as letting them find us for the most part. I mean, there's going to be some areas that you're... I mean, they have a great sense of smell. And we're going to, I mean, shark fishing, a lot of times it's the most boring fishing there is. It's the most simple, just set up and chum. There's going to be some other things you can do for certain species, but these aren't... you know, this isn't one species that there's so many of them that I'm going to go to this wreck and get a bunch of sharks off it, or go to this ledge or something and get a bunch of sharks off it. I know that they spend a lot of time coastal, so to me it makes more sense to find some place that there's going to be a fence line for an ambush point, so to speak. If a shark doesn't want to go up on top of an 8-foot shoal, but it's swimming in 35 feet of water at the base of the edge of a drop-off, I might try to get that down somewhere down that edge and let him find me. You know, then that'll all depend on how the current's moving and how I'm going to end up being able to fish it and set up accordingly. But, you know, the idea is let's face it, I'm here really just to work for the scientists. I'm not here to learn to find a new fishing spot and do any bragging at all. If they can tell me exactly where they are, that's where I'll go. I do the micro movements around a certain area and do the studying of whatever I can to position myself. But if I can go to, like a cave diving site, they're already established.
Sure.
You don't have to do anything from that. They've got them trained, so to speak. Those are their conditioned animals where they come to the boat as soon as you drop the anchor. You don't even have to chum on some of them, in Hans Bay and in False Bay, we don't even have to chum. You just slap a buoy on the surface of the water.
Here they come.
And there they come. Because that's what happens with the cage divers.
Okay.
They'll attach a little piece of tuna on the tail end or something to the buoy, and they'll throw it out there, and they'll tease them closer to the cage and get a better photograph and a better viewing of it, which is fine, but it just makes our life easier. We were down there. People were accusing us of chumming some exorbitant, like crazy amounts, like 50 tons a day, 5 tons a day. And it's I was making my guys sign every time they took a box out, and we were limiting ourselves to 25 kilos a day, which is a whole day, like a 50 pound tuna.
Right.
It's not much, because we didn't need it. You just slap a, I made a 12 foot Calcutta gaff into a buoy slapper. And I just swing it around and slap it 4 or 5 times on the surface and let it sit there. And it's crazy how fast the sharks all can come up to that noise of a buoy slapping and then follow it in. And then sometimes you couldn't get them off the buoy onto a bait because they think that the bait is on the buoy. I got to the point where I actually took a circle hook and put it inside a orange balloon. Blew it up and tied it because I was so frustrated not being able to switch them off the orange float. I said, I'm just going to do this. It didn't got late that day to move. I never actually did that. But I just thought, great would be if I could do that. Prove a point, anyway.
Sure.
And I have nothing against the cave diving sites. I think they do a great service to sharks in general, bringing people to respect them and love them in some instances. But it makes it better, easier for us to get our job done. And someone I come to another spot, it's the same thing. If they tell me where they're here, we have the guys that are here every day, and this is what they tell us the sharks are. Well, that's where we'll go.
That's where we'll go. Interesting. Well, we're back here, kind of in your office, which is the bow towards the bow of the boat, and the taco bar, and the taco bar is kind of a fun place. I've learned. Of course, it's full of tackle, and as you expect it to be. But tell us a little bit about this room, because this is where a lot of stuff happens.
Yep, I named this the tackle bar years ago when we first got this thing, and I put all the tackle stuff in here, and we had big rows of stainless tables, and then we have a walk-in refrigerator behind this wall,
okay.
and a walk-in freezer behind that, and so me and my original deckhand in the evening one time, we said, I think we could put a tap right through that wall, and have three kegs in that walk-in refrigerator, and we did it, and it worked great. Except then you have to drink a whole bunch of beer, and this is way too much for us. But it was dubbed the tackle bar ever since then, and it really is the social area of the boat in the evenings. This is where we're most comfortable, surrounded by rods and reels and tackle. I'm probably in here tinkering with something anyway.
Sure.
Me and Todd sit and tinker constantly and just try to perfect ourselves so when time comes we don't have a rush to get things ready. But it's a nice, comfortable environment, and it has a lot of history in here. And we've sat in here from the very early days at Guadalupe, just trying to, what do we have on this boat that we can modify and make this thing easier on us, and coming up with a design and new methods and stuff like that. And those were some real fond memories of trying to figure out the puzzle. To me, I think fishing, the most fun thing about fishing for me is figuring out the puzzle all the time. Once it becomes established and okay, this is the method, I lose interest and want to move on to the next puzzle.
Well, you talk about fiddling with things and all, and there are two things you showed me here today that I've just, you have to do this and fiddle and do and fiddle to figure it out. But one is the two pieces of wood on the hook that you use.
Yeah, the bite blocker.
The bite block.
Yeah.
Tell us, just take a minute and tell us about the bite
blocker.
The
bite blocker is nothing too new. It's just basic concept is, stopping the shark from eating any further up the line.
Okay.
If you drop the hook and the bait out of sight, because you think the sharks are swimming down deeper and you're just going to get a bite down there, then you lose some of the control. And we're in an environment where we're trying to control as much as we can, right?
Okay.
And we're working with scientists. They like in a controlled environment. So we take it on our, it all starts with the fishing, right? We have to get the specimen. So we try to control exactly where the hook placement is, make sure that every, we get 100% of them in the corner of the mouth, or at least in the forward part of the mouth,
okay,
because of this. You know, we fish a circle hook, but we also fish it with a bite blocker. And most of the time, if we have the ability to, we won't even fish deep unless we feel like we absolutely have to. If I can draw the shark to the surface and feed him right there,
right.
I mean, I'm fishing with rope and big hooks and stuff like that.
You're not that bait.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a very stealthy way of fishing, right? I give up a lot of bites in order to get the complete control over the few bites that I get. You know, and it's frustrating. It's, you know, I know sometimes, God, if I weren't lighter, I'd be getting bites right now. But I wouldn't have control over them. Then I might end into a 4 or 5 hour battle with a real big shark. And now I'm not doing what I'm promising them I'm going to do. You know, this is a totally different thing. This is not charter fishing. This is working specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And well, we wouldn't get the permits that we have if I had killed a shark by now.
Okay.
You know, I mean, every single shark weighs heavily on me. Has got this. If it goes bad, the world will know about it because we're fully transparent. We have newscasters and stuff that we don't have any control of what they show.
Right.
So I know that if I better do everything I can to make sure that there's never one failure. And that would never have been able to happen if I was fishing rod and reel for all this time on big sharks. You know, you lose control of the bite. You could have a bite blocker and take care of that. But if you have a charter guest and he's got the rod in his hand, then you don't even, I mean, you lose more control there, right? The heavy tackle is so important to reduce that. Like, I don't know if you were talking about it before. There really is no fight. It's a dance. I mean, we get back in front of them with that boat, put pressure on them, mm-hmm. and it's over.
And they follow.
Yeah, I mean, it's like saying that, you know, a bass fisherman that just won the classic. It's like, how long did you fight that bass for? It's like, I don't fight that bass. Mm-hmm. I got bit and skipped him across the surface, pulled him up, let him go perfectly healthy.
Yeah.
The faster it is, the more control you have, the better the fish is. So, yeah. It's just our game.
End of the day, this is a thinking man's question, and I love a guest who's passionate enough who can carry on for 20 minutes without me asking two questions. I love it. 20 years from now, 10, 15, 20 years from now, at the end of the day, what do you want out of O-Search and what you're doing right here, right now?
Well, put an awful lot into this. This is a lifetime I put into this. I could still be out there having a lot of fun fishing, doing offshore adventures kind of stuff. I gave up what I really love to do every day and to do something that I feel more strongly about and something more noble. When I started realizing what this could become and how many people we could reach, how many kids' lives we could affect, how we could change whole generations of kids' way of thinking about the ocean. So I want to see it continue. I want to see it be like, if me or Chris passed away right now, who knows what would happen? I'd like to see it to where it's actually always going to be here, and grow and become a movement in a way. You know, I'm a fisherman and a commercial fisherman background, so I'm somebody who can cross bridge, build bridges between
sure.
two people that okay. don't really trust each other that
right.
much. I like when I come into an area. Like up off Montauk, I know that there's squid fishermen up there probably a little worried about, are they going to put some restrictions on us because now they caught these white sharks in the squid zone and stuff like that. And it's like, well, the way I look, it would be the opposite. I said, I went up there. Somebody from San Diego has never fished Montauk, and in 4 days I got 9 big juvenile white sharks. That suggests to me that the populations are probably healthy enough to continue exactly what's going on. And I would like to see that the work that we do, instead of the laws being blanketed over whole regions that can't even be enforced and turning law-abiding citizens into criminals for trying to take their kids fishing, I'd like to see us learn, get enough knowledge, get that database up so we could. You can still preserve or put in conservation efforts for these fish that ensure they're sustained for the future without blanketing a whole area. So, look, just a little bit of change in the law here, a little bit there, and let the fishermen keep on making a living and don't overreach. You know, it's always this pendulum swings too far one way than the other one. I like to get the data, and we can all do this together. I want to see this ocean be healthy for my kids. That's more, now you know how when you're young, you become a pretty good fisherman, and you think, I'm one of the greatest fishermen. And then you learn a little more, and you realize, I don't know anything. And then you get a little better, and you start thinking that way again, and then you learn a little more. And then you start running a charter boat, and it's like you start, okay, I've caught enough fish for myself, but I really like to see the smiles on the people's faces. And then that's even becomes like, oh, that's still not enough. That's just somebody's happiness. Let's do something even more and make sure that the ocean is healthy enough for people to enjoy forever, because I want my kids to enjoy it the same way. And I enjoyed a very healthy ocean, and I've seen some changes in it. I'm in a position to be able to see changes over 40 years or 40 years plus. And so I started so young, so... conversation with the scientists here, and you tell those stories, and they trust you because they see the kind of person you are and your integrity, so they believe it. And then things you just get more done faster. I believe in what we do, and I'd like to see O-Search continue, and I'd like to see some of these methods and stuff be really studied and examined, because I got to be frank, I've taken an enormous amount of heat over the years. So why didn't you leave them in the water and this and that? So look, I believe wholeheartedly in what I do. My intentions sometimes get questioned, and it's like, look, who would want? What, there's not one part of me that wants to abuse animals or take more from the ocean. I'm trying to make it a healthier place and give back to it as much as I can. Some people might not agree with every method that we do, but I think a lot of them just don't understand it.
Yeah. Well, I think you got a good start, because, I can remember following O-Search, and especially with Mary Lee, because, she's like our Carolina girl. That was really the first one that came and set off South Carolina. And I think you've involved a ton of people. You look at the website, you look at the Facebook page, all the followers and all. I think you're doing great, and I think it's only going to grow from here. And we appreciate
I appreciate it. I'm sorry that you're out here on a bad day.
Oh, no.
And I know that it's not even that bad, but I think it's another thing that people don't understand. It's like we're a Bering Sea crabber. We can travel to anywhere in almost any weather. Yep. But when we get there, it's got to be almost flat calm to put the platform over and get there and do the work. So we have to block out a month and hope to get a quarter of those working days.
That's why they call it fishing.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you come back. If you do come back, I'd love to come back out. But in the meantime, let's keep in touch and
absolutely.
And let us know how O-Search is doing.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you out here, and nice to talk to you.
Appreciate it. And welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Brett McBride. Easy guy to talk to. Innovative. Some of those things they just learned on the fly. Didn't have a clue how to do it. Just did it and figured out like the bite blockers. Just two crossed wooden sticks to keep the hook from going so far down a shark's mouth. That's just experience teaching you what you need to do. So I hope you enjoyed it. We will run another segment, probably the first Saturday in June with, Chris Fisher. Because that day I'll be fishing in the Hooked on Hope charity bass fishing tournament down Lake Hartwell. I've been getting in some practice. I'm not backlashing near as much as I usually do and catching a few fish. I was on Lake Hartwell last week, was on Lake Murray this week. Got to do a little bit of red fishing with a couple of old friends of mine in Charleston on Tuesday. So if you want something to do, now's the time to go fishing. I actually even went to go trout fishing a few weeks ago, took Taylor and bought her a new pair of wading boots, and we went up and spent some quality father-daughter time up on the river. Didn't catch anything, but, it's not always about the catching. Sometimes it's just about being there and enjoying each other's company, and I hope if you do that sort of thing, I mean, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But anyway, let's get in a few things for the calendar events. As always, it's brought to you by Visit Anderson and Green Pond Landing and Event Center. I wanted to run down if you are looking for a youth fishing rodeo. I'm going to do this every week until they run out of them. On May the 13th, you can choose from a Goose Creek Rodeo in Berkeley County, the Barnwell County Fishing Rodeo in Barnwell, the Jimmy Shea Memorial Fishing Rodeo at Lick Fork Lake, Edgefield County, the Darlington County Fishing Rodeo in Darlington County, Forest Hills Subdivision Fishing Rodeo in Colleton County. And as always, if you
want more information on the fishing rodeos, you can go to www.dnr.sc.gov/aquatic-ed, and you can find out all the information you need there to find one of these. These are free. These are for kids, and they stock these ponds, so when you take a kid fishing in one of these things, they're going to catch fish. And if you don't know anything about fishing, then they also have family fishing clinics. And at the same website, you can find out about fishing clinics. There are some coming up May the 20th, Sun City Grandparents Park in Fort Mill, South Carolina, and the Lexington Wildlife Chapter, Emmanuel Church Road, Lexington, South Carolina, will both hold family fishing clinics on the 20th. And those are simply, if you don't know how to fish, you've either been a long time or you've never done it, it's a very simple course on how to put a rod and reel together, how to thread your line through the guides on the rod, how to tie a couple of simple knots to attach a hook, how to put a weight and a bobber on it, how to cast, and then they let you practice. So, you know, I was lucky enough to have my granddaddy teach me how to fish, but if you weren't and you don't know how to teach your kids, these are opportunities and clinics that you can go to, and they're free, and learn for yourself. And if you get together a few people, call DNR, say you'd like to have a fishing clinic. There are volunteer fishing clinic instructors across the state, and they'd be glad to set one up with you and have somebody come out and teach you how to fish. That's a great time. DNR's got a video out right now of the original handheld device. And we're not talking about cell phones, of course. We're talking about a fishing rod. And it's just a great one of how, you know, getting outdoors and fishing and talking to each other and, you know, going out to eat afterwards or before, how that was the original handheld device. It's pretty good commercial. If you haven't seen it, I'm sure you can Google it and find it. Anyway, after those things, I ran across this, and it's really, you know, you got to include something foodie every once in a while. And this is pretty cool. One morning in 1986, members of the Leesville Merchants Association flocked together to hatch the concept of a town festival. It was Sarah Sheely, famous throughout the region for eggs, extraordinary fried chicken served at her Batesville Leesville restaurant, who courageously proposed the development of a poultry festival for the Lexington County community. After much clucking and crowing, the head rooster called for a vote, and the poultry festival was hatched. Poultry festival is big in South Carolina. If you don't know about Sheely's Barbecue in Batesburg, Leesville, I feel sorry for you. You need to get down there and eat. It's $10 all you can eat for lunch, includes drink and dessert. But anyway, it's host of the number one world's best chicken cooking contest. It's happening on May the 12th, Batesburg, Leesville, South Carolina. It's west of Columbia, and they got lots of stuff going on. Nothing necessarily outdoor related, but they're going to have lots of bands, lots of fried chicken, stuff for the kids, carnival rides, that sort of thing. Racing pigs, tractor show. Going to have the NASCAR simulator there, so, and a cornhole tournament. So, like I said, it's not much to do with the woods and water, but it is something to do with South Carolina, and you got to have something food in here every once in a while. So, the South Carolina Poultry Festival, Thursday night 5 to 10, Friday 5 to 11:30, and Saturday 9:30 to 11:30. Parade is 10:15 on Saturday. Blue Wall Birding Festival. Tour some of the best bird-watching hotspots in the upstate as spring migration is winding down. Experienced birders will guide small groups to a variety of habitats within the mountains and upper Piedmont. Table Rock State Park will serve as our birding hub during this multi-day event. Trip choices for Friday and Saturday. One, you can go Nine Times Preserve in East Otoe Valley. Two, Townville, Lake Hartwell and Clemson areas. Three, Ashmore, Chandler and Bunched Arrowhead Heritage Preserves. Four, Table Rock and the Mountain Bridge Wilderness. Five, South Carolina Botanical Garden and Clemson University Aquaculture Facility. Optional trips have Nocturnal Birding Friday evening and Devil's Fork Lake Jocassee Boat Tour or Lake Conestee Natural Park on Saturday, Sunday. For specific field trip details or to register, send email to astegenga@scprt.com. Again, this is through the South Carolina Parks. It's happening May the 11th through May the 14th. Give them a call and see about going and watching some birds of South Carolina. Osprey Fish Eagle Boat Excursion. This is an exploration of the Stump Hole Swamp happening on May the 13th. Celebrate International Migratory Bird Day with a stopover adventure on Lake Mary and explore this unique lake habitat, including Osprey Village on the Stump Hole Swamp, on a two-hour boat excursion with Fish Eagle Nature Adventures. Journey into the heart of this important migratory stopover site. Possible sightings include a multitude of migratory species, including mergansers, yay, wood stork, night heron, ibis, kites, flycatchers, vireos, and warblers. It's Saturday, 10:30 to 12:30. Arrive by 9:45 at Santee State Park. That's in Santee, South Carolina. And you can go to the Center for Birds of Prey for more information on that one. Ladies, if you're looking to get involved in hiking, then the Palmetto Trail organization has it for you. They're going to do on May the 13th. They're going to do the low country portion of the Lake Moultrie Passage. It's 10 miles. It's easy on May the 13th. It's just an opportunity for you to get involved with other women who like the outdoors and enjoy each other's company and get to see nature, which is pretty cool. Low Country Trails Workday, May 13th and 27th. Meet at the Francis Marion office at 9 a.m. That's in Huger, South Carolina. If you're interested in attending a Palmetto Trail Workday, go to pcf.org and get involved. They're always looking for more volunteers to help finish the trail, help keep the trail maintained, and available for everybody to enjoy. And I forgot, almost forgot, there is, if you're going to be around Greenville next weekend, then, or actually today, that's right, it's today and tomorrow. It's, they've got the commemorative Air Force Dixie Wing is going to be at the Greenville Downtown Airport. They're going to have a P-51, an SBD-5 Dauntless, and the B-25 Mitchell. You can take rides in all of them. They're going to be at the Runway Cafe ramp. Hope you get out and do that. Well, I know it's been a busy day. Hope you've enjoyed it. As always, make time to get out there. Take the back roads when you can. Nothing to see on the interstates in South Carolina but other cars. But when you get off on the back roads, that's where South Carolina comes alive. And as always, don't forget the camera. I actually got a new lens for mine the other day, and it's working out pretty good. Because you never know when you want to take that one good picture. Hope you'll be back next week for more Woods and Water, South Carolina.